Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. All good martinis to wrap up the week for you. Good, good, and good. And Jim, we even have a good little nugget to get to before we even get to the martinis today, because the first round of the NFL draft went well for both of our teams. The Jets had moved up to the number 3 pick, and they got Sam Darnold, who you had mentioned many times during the 2017 season when things weren't going the Jets' way, that he was the silver lining. And turns out he was still available after the Cleveland Browns took Baker Mayfield number 1. And the Bears chose in the 8th slot and got, I think, certainly the best linebacker in the draft in Roquan Smith out of Georgia. So, Jim, for two franchises that aren't usually very good at this, I guess we got a little bit of the dragon energy.
Good way of putting it, Greg. I just want to put everyone, just keep this recording of this podcast. You may never hear Greg and me sounding this cheery and optimistic and bright and you know, happy and all of that. Yeah, I remember, you know, stink for Sam or less good taste versions of that. Who would have figured that? Look, you know, for every team and for all these young men, it's a great, wonderful moment. You get to see them striding out on the stage. You just feel bad for just a couple of them. I don't just mean the ones who, you know, didn't get picked and are still waiting down in that little, you know, waiting room in Dallas. Also, you got to feel bad for Baker Mayfield going to Cleveland. I'm sure he's a great player, but man, you think of all the highly touted college players that have gone to Cleveland and we've never seen them again. The side of milk cartons, Greg. And by that, I mean, like, because the Browns are usually so bad and never on Monday Night Football or our nationally televised games, like, they might be good. I just never see them anymore.
Except for the one game every few years where they actually play your team and like, oh, yeah, that guy's still in the league. Yeah, it's amazing. But let's get to our real job here. Let's start with Korea, the Korean Peninsula. The summit, of course, involving President Trump and Kim Jong-un is believed to be coming up here in a couple of months. But yesterday, the leaders of North Korea and South Korea got together. And here's how the New York Times reported it, and Jim posted in the Morning Jolt today. The leaders of North and South Korea agreed on Friday to work to remove all nuclear weapons from the Korean Peninsula and within the year pursue talks with the United States to declare an official end to the Korean War, which ravaged the two nations from 1950 to 1953. At a historic summit meeting, the first time a North Korean leader had ever set foot in the South, the leaders vowed to negotiate a peace treaty to replace a truce that has kept an uneasy peace on the divided Korean Peninsula for more than 6 decades, while ridding it of nuclear weapons. A peace treaty has been one of the incentives North Korea has demanded in return for bargaining away its nuclear weapons. So, Jim, as you point out right at the start of the jolt today, trust but verify was essentially made for regimes like North Korea, which has lied to the United States and many others for decades. I can still see them trying to just wiggle out of sanctions pain that's been inflicted by the Trump administration and others, maybe improving its reputation on the international stage so as it represses its people, it doesn't get as much blowback. So all of those thoughts are still in the back of the head, of course. But the fact that this opportunity is availing itself, let's continue hoping something good comes out of it.
Indeed, Greg. The sense of a potential lasting peace, or at least a serious de-escalation of the tensions and hostilities between North Korea on one side and South Korea and the United States on the other side. Greg, a good way of putting it is this is our draft choices. It is unverified. It's all based on potential, but we have high hopes for the future. And, you know, here's the thing, though. There are a couple of reasons to think that this is more than the typical feints. North Korea has, at the very least, kept there are certain ways of verifying good behavior that are fairly obvious. They have not set off any, done any nuclear testing. I'll get to have another point about that in a second. They have not launched any ICBMs and tests of that. Now, an interesting bit of information coming our way from Chinese geologists. Their best assessment is that the underground mountain base that they used to test their nuclear weapons from the last test in September didn't go the way the North Koreans expected, and they may have had the entire base collapse. The reaction got out of control and the entire mountain came down on the facility, meaning it's completely unusable and, oh, by the way, radioactive. So if you accidentally blow up your nuclear program, maybe you're more in the mood to negotiate giving it, you know, ending it because you accidentally blew it up and can't use it anymore. We don't want to overstate this. This is a regime that has can turn on a dime and has, you know, broken promises before and things like that. But I have a piece that's now on the editor's desk at National Review talking to a gentleman who is involved in a lot of negotiations with North Korea over the past 25 years in different roles of government. And he says, look, the North Korean regime really is worried about the economy. And it's one of those things where you might be going, really? I thought they were all starving. But I guess the sense is that even by the standards of North Korea, they have an awareness of the state of the economy, access to hard capital and hard cash and things like that. And his, you know, his sense is the sanctions are having a bite. And that so maybe, you know, between when you blow up your nuclear program, you've really gotten to the played the brinksmanship card as much as possible with the United States. And you've paid an economic price. Maybe North Korea really does want to say, OK, time for a change of approach here. Maybe we can, you know, loosen some of these sanctions. I'm just going to close with a really fascinating assessment from Ian Bremmer, a foreign policy kind of wonk scholar kind of guy who has a really interesting couple of tweets this morning. Among them saying, you know, when the North and South Korean leaders commit to no more war on the peninsula, that's the best news you're going to hear all year. Perhaps really fascinatingly, Greg, he adds, I've been critical of Trump foreign policy missteps in the past year. TPP, Paris, too many unnecessary missteps with allies to count. But today's historic North-South Korea breakthrough does not happen without priority and pressure from the American president. Trump deserves full credit. He says, Trump, Xi, Moon, and Kim together get my vote for the Nobel Peace Prize. And he adds, obviously, there's still a lot of work to do before there is a sustainable peace. I just want to go out and, you know, pinch Ian Bremmer's cheeks when he points this out. It's not like the Nobel Committee doesn't give peace prizes in advance of accomplishment. Now, do they? Thinking of Obama's 2009 Nobel Peace Prize. So, if this really pans out, this is a remarkable accomplishment for any American president, much less this president, who has at times been a bull in a china shop on the world stage. Maybe the Trumpian combination of tough talk and sanctions and a sense that we have a president who was not willing to throw whatever concessions were necessary to get North Korea to quiet down for a while. Maybe it worked. We don't want to overstate it, but just some remarkable images coming out of Korea now, seeing the two leaders shake hands and even embrace. I don't know about you. I'm not that much of a hugger. So, that's a sign that summit's going really well.
Well, yeah, I would guess so. And the president of South Korea is a big, big fan of the idea of reunifying the peninsula. So let's hope he doesn't give away the store to do that. Jim, I can just sense some Democrats saying, look at all you conservatives and Republicans. You're all over Obama trying to thwart the Iranian threat. He got a deal and you guys dumped all over it. And now a Republican president tries to do the same thing with North Korea and everybody's fawning all over it. I would say the difference is we haven't actually given away anything yet, much less the store. And oh, by the way, if there is an agreement here, I would assume we would actually verify that the nuclear program is in fact destroyed.
It's interesting. I've mentioned once or twice I'm reading a really extensive biography of Gorbachev. And it is worth noting that the real acceleration in the economic reforms, the openness, glasnost, and the summit meetings with Reagan came after the Chernobyl disaster. That basically the Soviets were absolutely convinced of the you know endless superiority of, if not their entire military machine, because we all heard the jokes about lousy, you know, Russian-made automobiles and shoddy Russian-made clothing and all these other ways in which, surprise, surprise, communist workers with no incentives to work harder were generating crappy products. There was always this enormous Soviet pride in their nuclear program, that they too had split the atom. They too had figured out how to harness it. And all of a sudden Chernobyl happens. And all of a sudden there's this sense of, oh, wait a second. Maybe this arsenal we've built isn't quite as reliable as they think we are. Maybe this system isn't working. And maybe it's time for us to look at things in a different light. If what happened in North Korea's mountaintop nuclear base is what happened, I wonder if there is kind of this same parallel of a disaster forcing a complete rethinking of the regime's worldview. And if you doubt the example of the Soviet Union, Greg, I would just look at the Klingon Empire in Star Trek VI. where the moon of Praxis exploded and the Klingon Empire came to the negotiating table.
It's an excellent point, and I was going to make another reference to Rocky IV. I think Rocky IV, with Rocky defeating Drago, followed by Chernobyl just a few months later. I mean, if that's not the handwriting on the wall for Gorbachev, I'm not sure what was.
If you're thinking Trump is an unusual figure to lead to peace on the peninsula, I will just quote the old Vulcan proverb that Spock quotes in that movie. Only Nixon could go to China.
All right, let's move on to our second good martini today. And yesterday, in his never-ending book tour, former FBI Director James Comey arrived on the set of Fox News Special Report with Brett Baer. He's about 15 minutes late, but nonetheless, he was there. And the way Brett Baer was prepared, the next half hour was plenty of time for him to pepper Comey with plenty of questions. They were excellent questions, many of which should have been asked many times in the past, but somehow weren't by other media outlets. And he got some interesting answers, to say the least. So the second good martini is Excellent Journalism by Brett Baer. And Jim Comey with some really odd answers here. Let's start with Brett Baer asking him about the fact that the Democrats funded the Steele dossier.
When did you learn that the DNC and Hillary Clinton campaign had funded Christopher Steele's work?
Yeah, I still don't know that for a fact.
What do you mean?
I've only seen it in the media. I never knew exactly which Democrats had funded. I knew it was funded first by Republicans, opposed to Donald.
But that's not true.
I'm sorry?
That's not true. That the dossier that Christopher Steele worked on was funded by Republicans?
Yeah, my understanding was his work started funded by Oppo Research, funded by Republicans.
So Free Beacon and said that they had Glenn Simpson and Fusion GPS on a kind of a retainer, but they did not fund the Christopher Steele memo or the dossier. That was initiated by Democrats.
Okay, my understanding was the activity was begun, that Steele was hired to look into, was first funded by Republicans, then picked up, the important thing was picked up by Democrats opposed to Donald Trump.
That's a nice shifty change to his answer from where he started there, Jim. But given his lack of curiosity, for some reason, he still made it a big part of the FISA warrant push for Carter Page.
Why did you use that to the FISA court to ask for surveillance for Carter Page? Not only use it, but you led with it. A bulk of that FISA application deals with that dossier. Why?
Yeah, that's not my recollection, Brett. And I don't know that the FISA application has been released. My recollection was it was part of a broader mosaic of facts that were laid before the FISA judge to obtain a FISA warrant.
And did he ever bother to tell President-elect Trump any of this?
Did you inform the President-elect at the time what you knew about how it was funded or who was behind it?
No, I did not.
Did you inform him that Christopher Steele had been fired by the FBI?
No.
Or that he had lied?
No, and I didn't know those things at that time anyway.
Or that it had been used, at least in part, to get this FISA application to spy on somebody in his campaign?
No, didn't come up.
My personal favorite, though, Jim, is James Comey claiming he didn't leak.
FBI protocol says your own employment agreement with the FBI prohibits, quote, the unauthorized disclosure of any information or material from or related to FBI files or any information acquired by virtue of my official employment without prior written permission from the FBI. Did you have written permission?
No, and I didn't consider it part of an FBI file, all the things that I talked about
you
with Anderson.
You wrote it as an FBI director. It was a work product.
No, it was not. It was my personal aide de memoir.
You were talking to the president?
Sure. I created two copies of it, one to keep in my personal safe at home, and I left another one at the FBI so the Bureau could always have access to it. But I always thought of it as mine, like a diary.
Jim, if this had been a prize fight, they would have stopped this in the second or third round. But thankfully, they kept it going because Brett Baer showed what a journalist should do, and Jim Comey shows that his account is pretty weak here.
What he says, I still don't know that's the fact, that Hillary's campaign and the DNC paid for the dossier. I kind of love the befuddled, what do you mean? From Brett Baer, because I myself didn't know that fact was in dispute, and nothing I've seen since Comey's comment indicates to me that there's he says, well, it's only in media reports. Did somebody forward it to him in an email and he's kind of skeptical, or he saw it on Facebook or something? This is basically the Comey version of fake news. The only way that exchange could have been any better, Greg, is if Brett Baer had said, no, actually we now know it's very clear that Hillary Clinton and the DNC picked up where the Free Beacon left off and paid for the majority of the work done in the Steele dossier. That if Comey had said, oh, wow, that changes everything, doesn't it? Huh? Oh, man. Oh, I should not have done that. He didn't. basically the FBI is saying, hey, you know, this this document that we put before the FISA court, or this information that we put in there requesting the ability to check into Carter Page. Apparently Comey didn't know where it came from. Didn't think to ask, didn't care to ask. It didn't seem all that important at the time. And that's not reassuring about Comey's judgment and all this, that he's, you know, making this decision, apparently not knowing the origin of the information. And I think most of us would say, look, when it comes from campaign opposition research, maybe you take it with a grain of salt. Maybe you're a little bit more wary or skeptical than you might otherwise be. The other bit of the exchange there is that it really, like, this is Schrodinger's memo, Greg. It is simultaneously a government document and not a government document, depending upon what Comey needs at any particular given moment, because he's insisting, no, this is entirely personal, Brett. This is like a personal diary entry that you managed to make a copy of and keep at your workplace. Wait, what? Look, it's one or the other. If it is entirely his own personal memo, then I suppose that's fine, but it's not like, dear diary, I met with President Trump today. You know, it's not the hopes and dreams that I'm picturing him doodling in the margins and things like that. This is, you know, he very clearly was creating this as his record of his meeting with the president to protect himself. If at some point the president had, you know, made what in his mind false claims about their meeting, et cetera, et cetera. And when you're keeping it in a safe at work, I just don't buy the argument of, oh, no, this is a totally personal document and I'm totally okay for me to leak this or ask a Columbia professor to leak this to the media or something like that. Look, I think it's been a really rough couple of weeks for James Comey. And the great irony, of course, is that probably up until his first couple of interactions with Trump, you can either defend or justify or at least see where he's coming from on most of his decisions. But then something about Trump turns him into this rather this guy who does not live up to any of the principles of honor and integrity and honesty and straightforwardness and, you know, Dudley Do Right Boy Scout type stuff that he seems to tout himself in the rest of the book.
Question on Brett Baer, who I think did an excellent job yesterday. My question is, was this an absolutely sterling performance by him, or is everybody else so not good at this that he looks really good by comparison? My guess is it's probably both.
A little bit of both. Let's also point out that when you're doing the third or fourth big interview of James Comey, as opposed to the first one, people might say, ah, it's not as fresh, it's not as new, but you've already had the basic questions addressed by all the previous ones. And you can look back on those previous interviews and say, okay, where does he hedge his words a little bit in this one? Or where is he a little imprecise in his description? So I think it kind of helped Brett Baer to kind of hone in on it. The other two observations I will have, or one last observation I'll have there, Greg, it is kind of funny. And you know, I think a lot of people, when he was not available at the beginning of the show, when Comey was scheduled to do this interview with Brett Baer, the explanation was he was stuck in traffic. A lot of people naturally wondered, oh, goodness, is Comey trying to get out of this? Is he, you know, knowing that he's had softballs in previous interviews that Brett Baer is going to really come at him and ask him tough questions, is he ducking it? Now, the explanation is just, you know, he eventually did make it. He just hadn't accounted for the traffic. Greg, you think he really got used to having lights and sirens over the years in D.C. traffic?
Could be.
I'm just going to tell you, Greg, Scott Pruitt would not have missed that meeting.
Traffic was terrible yesterday, morning and evening. Anyway, what else is new? All right, let's go on to our third and final good martini. Takes us back to Broward County, Florida. We don't get a lot of good martinis out of Broward, but here we go. Fox News, a union of deputies in Florida on Thursday announced it has no confidence in Broward County Sheriff Scott Israel. The Broward Sheriff's Office Deputies Association said a symbolic vote among its members initiated last week indicated 534 of 628 officers in the union, that's about 85%, voted they had no confidence in the sheriff. The association, a chapter of the International Union of Police Associations, cited the national criticism surrounding Israel and his office following the mass shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School on February 14th. And of course, we learned since then the school resource officer never went in, and the deputies that first arrived did not go in. They kind of took a defensive position behind their cars or their car doors. Sheriff Israel, in response to the announcement of a vote, said union boss Jeff Bell was trying to, quote, use the Parkland tragedy as a bargaining tactic to extort a 6.5% raise from the sheriff's office, according to the Sun Sentinel. Bell says that the association's next step is to present the vote to Florida Governor Rick Scott, who rejected calls from some state legislators to suspend Israel after the shooting. They will now ask Scott to, quote, please make a change and replace the sheriff with somebody who is capable of amazing leadership. Jim, I can maybe see the deputies looking to avoid a little blame here, but obviously they were ordered to do what they did, with the possible exception of Scott Peterson. There should be a price to pay here, and it looks like it might be coming due here for Scott Israel.
Yeah, now as we're gathering information to do this podcast, Greg, you know, you and I both look at a lot of different sources. By any chance, did you happen to get that story on the revolt or the vote of no confidence amongst the Broward County law enforcement officers? You didn't have to get that from CNN, did you? Did you, Greg?
Nope, did not.
Okay, because I wonder if CNN might want to really put a lot of resources into this story. Considering how they helped turn him into a star, did that town hall meeting just a couple of days after the shooting in Florida. I basically gave him the floor to emphasize how terrible Dana Loesch was and to not really be held accountable for any of the actions of his own law enforcement, which we then subsequently learned was just an abominable dereliction of duty there. It became very clear that this guy loved the spotlight, loved to, you know, was going to wrap himself not just in the flag, but in the cause of gun control. And perhaps he thought this would be a way for him to escape scrutiny of both not just the decision that particular day, but also the run-up, all the run-ins the county police had with this particular troubled individual. And then the general policy, which many people have raised questions about, of trying to de-emphasize criminalization of underage perpetrators. When a kid gets in trouble, you have the option of letting him off with a warning or you know, school detentions or things like that, or giving him a criminal record that will follow him his whole life. Very nice idea in theory. But one of the consequences of this is that maybe people who should have a criminal record don't get one. And as a result, they don't have a criminal record when they go to purchase a firearm. A lot of really fair questions being asked about this sheriff. And I just kind of think it'd be a good idea. Maybe CNN would like to do a do-over on that town hall. I know that a good portion of our listeners and folks who read National Review do not think very highly of CNN. I think I have a slightly higher opinion of them than most other folks. But I think this is a moment where they really did not live up to their own purported values, their own purported, the way they see themselves. If you want to be the most trusted name in news, you probably should recognize that you gave this sheriff a soapbox to demonize other people unfairly, like Dana Loesch and the gun owners of America, and then generally just to avoid accountability for a complete and total failure in law enforcement. So hopefully that'll come to pass. I think this vote of no confidence is an important step for accountability down there in Florida.
Absolutely right. And hopefully it'll protect the lives of other people either there or elsewhere in response to the horrific response from the sheriff's department. So you're absolutely right. And CNN, I mean, we've talked about it a lot. They sent their anchors down there and it was basically a 48 to 72 hour ad for gun control. As long as they were basing their programming in Parkland, it was absolutely unbalanced from start to finish. So, Jim, it's nice to end the week on three good martinis. I like it so much, I'm going to take a couple days off early next week. You'll have a couple of guest hosts to break in next week, but I'll be back with you on Wednesday.
Well, I'm looking forward to that, Greg. The good ones will start on Wednesday. No, we'll be really good on Monday.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Monday for the next Three Martini Lunch.